1. Was the device which was the proximate cause of President Kennedy's death triggered by someone in the limousine or on the limousine or outside it? 2. Who prepared this device for the execution of President Kennedy? 3. Who had control over the limousine immediately prior to its use in Dallas? To generalize is to omit. It is in the details of things where the truth lies. There is no doubt in my mind that a number of persons were involved in the conspiracy to kill President Kennedy. No doubt at all. It took a group of experts to install the death device. It took another group to cause distraction. And it took only one person to trigger the death device, the shaped charge, outside the limousine by remote control through a radio signal. President Nixon once said that only three persons in the United States understood power. One was himself, another was Nelson Rockefeller, the other was John Conley, who was almost eliminated in the Kennedy ambush. We all know that power corrupts and that thieves eventually fall out among themselves. Nixon has been eliminated, and now only Rockefeller and Conley remain. Which will win the power play to rule us all? Are we reduced to these two power blocks? Are there no other alternatives? Who will remain to use the CIA as his own personal tool? Why not abolish this CIA, this private super Gestapo agency, now controlled by the Rockefeller brothers themselves? Why not have a congressional investigation and a grand jury investigation by opening the Kennedy assassination to answer these and other questions? I leave it to you, dear listeners. To be aware is to care, and to care is to act. I turn now to topic number 2. A generation ago, the so-called third generation of the Rockefellers began rapidly taking over the reins of one of the world's biggest economic empires from their father, John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Of the 6 members of the third generation, 5 brothers and a sister, 2 proved to be relatively easygoing and content by Rockefeller standards with their immense inherited wealth. These 2 were the sister Abby and the late Winthrop Rockefeller, who served as governor of Arkansas for a time. But the other 4 brothers were incredibly ambitious, more so than even their grandfather, John D. Sr., and more ruthless as well. They considered the immense empire they had inherited to be merely a convenient springboard from which to launch really big things. Their father, John D. Jr., had been in the forefront of those who sought to dismantle the Christian faith and remake it into a humanistic, man-made philosophy. And in this connection, he had brought up his children to believe that they were uniquely endowed and chosen to rule the world. In the case of the 4 brothers, John D. III, Nelson, Lawrence, and David, this training took. And for several decades, these 4 brothers have worked tirelessly as a unit in a relentless conquest for control of America and domination of the world for their own mother Russia. In this connection, they were simply carrying forward some of the things that their father and grandfather had already started. But they did so with greater diligence and vastly greater resources than their forebears had had at their disposal. The 4 brothers long ago divided up the world into spheres of influence for each to concentrate on. John D. III carved out Asia and Africa for his special attentions and also emerged in the forefront of many so-called philanthropic activities, although the philanthropic image or halo is one cultivated by all of the Rockefellers. As I mentioned in my monthly audio letter number 1 for June 1975, John was personally involved in the spy nest plotting at Lee, Massachusetts, which laid the groundwork for the Pearl Harbor attack, which dragged an unwilling America into World War II. His participation in this plotting was done under the cloak of a supposedly philanthropic international activity called the Institute of Public Relations, or IPR. After the war, the IPR was abolished after congressional investigations exposed its infamous role against America. It's interesting that John is taking a more visible stance than usual these days, hitting the propaganda drive that is intended to pave the way for the secret new Constitution I've described in my latest audio book on that subject. For example, the Rockefeller-controlled Hertz Rent-A-Car Company has just launched a new magazine for customers called Number One, and the inaugural issue contains a cover article titled, quote, John D. Rockefeller III, Some Strong Ideas Americans Can Use in the Second Revolution, unquote. In that article, John's involvement in the IPR is paraded as if it were something to be proud of. But it doesn't mention that after Japan was defeated in the war that the IPR helped bring about, John D. Rockefeller III swooped down with his entourage and proceeded to take over the Japanese economy lock, stock, and barrel, consolidating great chunks of it into a huge cartel called the Zaibatsu. The Zaibatsu. The so-called economic miracle of Japan is, in fact, no more surprising than the remarkably American appearance of this Asian giant since the war. Since World War II, both America and Japan have been under Rockefeller control. After all, even Sony, S-O-N-Y, stands for nothing more than the former Standard Oil Company of New York. Turning now to Nelson, I have said much elsewhere, particularly in monthly audio letter number one, and suffice it to say that he carved out the United States and Latin America for his special focus and has played the role of inside man in our government ever since the days when he was the so-called closest advisor of Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was a complete puppet of the Rockefellers. To enhance his Latin American image, Nelson has for many years pretended great enthusiasm over Latin American art of all kinds. But in Latin America itself, his rapacious economic activities in the past helped create the image which has been termed the ugly American. And he was long ago labeled public enemy number one by certain Latin American newspapers. Then there is Lawrence Rockefeller, who received some unfavorable publicity during the confirmation hearings for Nelson's vice presidency. It was Lawrence, of course, who financed the celebrated anti-Goldberg book to help Brother Nelson in his gubernatorial reelection campaign in 1970. Judging from the testimony, shelling out $60,000 for this purpose apparently took about as much deliberation as buying a box of paper clips would for you or me. Moral scruples don't appear to have been a problem, but appearances were, since the $60,000 was carefully laundered through a roundabout legal route so that the source of the book's financing would not be readily apparent. Lest anyone should consider such shenanigans suspicious, though the testimony contains a beautiful example of the kind of logic the Rockefeller brothers use regularly to befuddle their critics. It was stated that this circuitous routing and disguising of funds for the book wasn't laundering at all, but merely a very common practice in Rockefeller dealings. In other words, they hide what they do all the time, so therefore it must be okay. Here, my friends, is just one hint of the fact that Rockefeller control is extremely pervasive throughout our society, but it is hidden from our view more often than not. At any rate, Lawrence's domain includes the airlines, aerospace, and arms industries of the Rockefellers, who are the world's biggest and most aggressive merchants of death. It also includes the stock market and its manipulation. As you see the stock market crash I have been warning about developing before our eyes, you can send your thank you notes to Lawrence Rockefeller. Finally, we come to David Rockefeller, the youngest of the four brothers, and the most powerful of them all. David is chairman of the Mammoth Chase Manhattan Bank, one of the two or three largest bank networks in the world, with over 2,000 branches in some 98 countries throughout the entire world. Chase Manhattan is a prime source of loan funds to the largest companies in America and abroad, and its trust department owns huge amounts of stock in companies that constitute the backbone of the American economy. By granting or denying loans, by hiring ex-CIA agents, by applying pressure on companies that are in debt to Chase Manhattan, including pressure to change the makeup of boards and directors of corporations, banks, insurance companies, etc., by selectively buying and selling stocks, and by other means, David Rockefeller is in a position to pull some very powerful strings just through Chase Manhattan alone. But even Chase Manhattan Bank is the only tiny, visible tip of David Rockefeller's iceberg. David Rockefeller is no ordinary banker. He's the key custodian of the incredible worldwide Rockefeller financial empire. And through it, he is the most powerful international banker in the world. The Rockefellers control not only Chase Manhattan Bank, but many of the other key money houses both in America and abroad. They control the First National City Bank of New York, the largest in New York City, plus a number of the other major New York banks. They also control many banks where their cartel is not widely recognized, such as the Bank of America, which is the largest bank in the United States, and also the multinational banks abroad, including many investment banking houses here and abroad. The fact that the Rockefellers have succeeded in taking over the huge Morgan interests, which used to be the biggest competitors of the Rockefellers in America, comes as a distinct shock to many people. After all, Morgan Guaranty Trust reportedly maintains a stock portfolio worth $23.5 billion at the present time, the biggest in America. Well, my friends, no less than 16 of the 24 directors of Morgan Guaranty Trust are now Rockefeller agents. And since some have found it unbelievable that Morgan Guaranty is now Rockefeller-dominated, I'm now going to name these 16 directors and Rockefeller-controlled organizations in which they are kingpins. They are J. Paul Austin of Coca-Cola, R. Manning Brown, Jr. of the New York Life, Frank T. Carey of IBM, one of the five multinationals which the Rockefellers used in 1971-72, to launch stagflation through monetary manipulations in Europe, W. Graham Clayton, Jr. of the Southern Railway, Emilio G. Collado of Exxon, the largest corporation in the world and the apple of the Rockefellers' eye, Charles D. Dickey, Jr. of Scott Paper, John T. Dorrance, Jr. of Campbell Soup, Louis W. Foyle of Bethlehem Steel, Thomas S. Gates, formerly of the Defense Department, Howard W. Johnson of MIT, Donald P. Kircher of the Singer Company, Donald E. Prochnow of Western Electric, Warren M. Shapley of Ralston Purina, George P. Schultz, one of the Fort Knox Gold conspirators, who has been paid off with the presidency of the Rockefeller's Bechtel Corporation and as a consultant to many of David Rockefeller's corporations, Olcott D. Smith of Aetna Life and Casualty, and Henry S. Wingate of the International Nickel Company of Canada. Their financial empire also includes many of the largest life insurance companies. It also includes control of the privately owned central bank system that causes our money to be printed, the Federal Reserve System. Through control, direct and indirect, of both the Federal Reserve and the top officials of the United States Treasury, David Rockefeller was able to remove America's gold, as I have discussed elsewhere. For details on that, I refer you to my audio book on the Fort Knox Gold Scandal and to the update in my monthly audio letter number 2 for July 1975. David Rockefeller himself is a director of the New York Federal Reserve Bank Board of Directors. Paul Volcker is now president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, and he was a former Assistant Secretary for International Monetary Affairs, and he helped David to take the gold from Fort Knox with the other people involved. The Fort Knox gold scandal cover-up conspiracy keeps right on spreading as they try to cover their tracks. The chairman of the Senate and House Banking Committees, Senator Proxmire and Congressman Henry Royce, respectively, are trying to keep the lid on the Fort Knox gold controversy long enough to let the Treasury devise some sort of publicity gimmick to trick the public once again, as they did with the so-called gold inspection visit in September 1974. And to this end, I've just been informed that an attempt is now being made to put some borrowed gold bars into the central core vault at Fort Knox, whose existence I revealed for the first time last month, and which has been empty up to this point. But it's going to be very, very difficult to return over 753,000 bars of gold to that central core vault. All of these things and much more, my friends, lie within David Rockefeller's bailiwick. It was David Rockefeller who single-handedly turned our Middle East policy around in February 1974 in order to prevent his Middle East oil empire from being wrenched out of Rockefeller control in connection with the Arab oil embargo. King Faisal of Saudi Arabia was, as you will recall, a key to the success of that unified Arab action. And in doing what he did, he was placing what he judged to be the Arabs' best interests above those of the Rockefellers. For 30 years, since acquiring the Saudi oil fields by means of World War II and developing them initially with free GI labor at taxpayers' expense, the Rockefellers had had their own way. The net price of Arab oil to the Rockefellers during that 30 years, thanks to chargebacks and various devices, was only 5 cents a barrel. Imagine, crude oil at 5 cents a barrel for over 30 years. What immense profits inured to the Rockefellers. But King Faisal had now decided to put his own people's interests first, just as John Kennedy had done for America in 1963. Both actions amounted to a double-crossing of the Rockefellers, and both resulted in assassination little more than a year afterward. It's not possible to discuss the dimensions of Rockefeller control more than superficially in so short a time, but perhaps you can begin to grasp some idea how it works. They own controlling interests in over 300 multinational banks and corporations, hiding the bulk of this ownership through the use of many thousands of nominees and so-called street names. Through their control of banks and foundations, they're able to create well-disguised director interlocks through which they are able to run their entire giant economic empire as one huge cartel. The monopolistic practices of John D. Rockefeller Sr. pale by comparison with the runaway international monster that has been put together by the four Rockefeller brothers. And this economic empire built around multinational corporations, which yield allegiance to no country but to the Rockefellers instead, is increasingly a political empire as well. As time goes on, their control over what remains outside their grasp is spreading even more rapidly. On July 30, 1975, the Rockefeller interests took a decisive step toward consolidation of their control over still another major power base in America, the Teamsters Union. On that day, according to information which has just reached me, the abduction of former Teamster President James R. Hoffa was accomplished on behalf of the Rockefellers. The reason? Frank Fitzsimmons, the current Teamster president, is being drawn into the web of Rockefeller control. Hoffa, embarking on a concerted drive to regain control of the Teamsters, constituted a distinct threat to Rockefeller progress in this area. And the Rockefellers seek every bit of control that they can possibly achieve over the distribution systems of our nation as a critical tool in producing massive supply disruptions and shortages in the near future. These, in turn, are to form part of the economic breakdown by which they plan to make us accept their dictatorial new constitution. The stakes are very high, and Jimmy Hoffa got in the way, possibly without ever realizing it. I turn now to topic number three. In October 1974, I recorded my first audio book, entitled How to Protect Yourself During the Coming Depression and Third World War. In that tape, I reported that World War III was being planned to begin in a few short years, that it would be nuclear war with America as a main battleground, and that it would drag for over a year. Then in March 1975, in my audio book on the Fort Knox Gold Scandal and What It Means to You, I reported that the war plans were still on track and explained their purpose to you more fully. As I mentioned in that second tape, the Rockefellers were beginning to be thrown off balance by their difficulties in keeping the lid on the Fort Knox Gold Scandal, which, if it ever breaks into the open, could blow them out of the water, insofar as their dictatorship plans are concerned. And as I say these words, these and other problems have so far prevented Nelson Rockefeller from making good his plan to expel Gerald Ford from the presidency and confer that office upon himself. There are ominous signs lately that he is now gearing up to do this as soon as the time is right. It hasn't happened yet. Yes, Nelson Rockefeller has probably made me look foolish in the eyes of some people because he failed to become president on his schedule of June 1975. I began publicly spotlighting Rockefeller's plan to do this over a year ago, before Gerald Ford became president, and before he surprised everybody by selecting Rockefeller from an initial field of 15 to nominate him as vice president. But, my friends, my very purpose in revealing the confidential information I receive about these things is to prevent them from happening, if I can. I'm not one of those who, by psychic or other means, I go around predicting doom and gloom and then gleefully say, "See, I told you so," if it comes true. The things I'm trying to warn you about are terrible things, not just for you, but for me too. I don't want them to happen. This is a beautiful, wonderful land that God has given to us to live in. And I want my three small children, as well as yours, to have the blessings of freedom with which to enjoy it when they grow up. In this spirit, I'm glad to be able to tell you of changes in the Rockefeller plans, whenever these reflect failures or slippages in their diabolical scheming. And I can report to you that alterations in the war plans are now in the works, not because of anything I have done, but because of what Indira Gandhi of India has done. You probably have heard some short-lived news reports in connection with recent events in India, suggesting that the CIA might have been involved in some way. These suggestions were quickly brushed aside and hushed up by our own government, but they happen to be true. If you share the image that most Americans have of India, you probably think of teeming, overpopulated cities filled with underfed people, sacred cows wandering through the streets, vast bureaucrats' problems, and much else, and not much else at that. But India is much more than that, possessing a very considerable industrial base and relatively unexploited natural resources, such as always attract the greedy attention of the Rockefellers. For 5 years now, the CIA has been working its way into position to stage a takeover of India, just as has been done elsewhere repeatedly. Just as Portugal was thrown into revolution over a year ago under a 10-year Rockefeller plan, and just as the Union of South Africa is scheduled for extinction by the Rockefellers 3 years from now, India was under attack. And Indira Gandhi, the only really strong leader in India today, was being systematically undermined by an Indian-style Watergate staged through there as here by the CIA in behalf of the Rockefellers. But Indira Gandhi confounded everybody. She confounded everyone with her ferocious counterattack. It's tragic that, at this point at least, she has gone so far with this counterattack that she appears to have destroyed the very foundations of freedom she intended to defend. But what triggered the recent events in India was the meddling of the CIA in her internal affairs. As a result, the war plans I have warned you about up to now are being put on a back burner. They could come to the fore again, but India is such a huge prize that the war plans are now being revised on India's account. The new plan that is rapidly emerging now calls for war to begin in March 1977 with Red China and Japan attacking India. The alliance under which this would occur is already forming now. While our eyes were focused recently on the Helsinki Summit Conference to ratify Soviet conquests in Europe, the real action was going on in Asia. The Sino-Japanese Treaty of Peace and Friendship is now being negotiated as the first step toward a military alliance. As things are progressing now, these two will attack India in 1977, and Russia will come to the so-called aid of India. The United States will then be sucked into the fray, serving as a factory to supply Russia and India, and the purpose of all would be to take over India in a different way. All this reflects a rapid and major change away from the trend that existed prior to the recent events in India. This war is planned sooner than the original schedule for World War III, since the new plans no longer call for Russia to join the new Far East Axis, but instead to be on the other side. And, of course, the new plans do not involve hostilities on American soil as they stand right now. Keep in mind, though, that further changes can and probably will occur. In particular, should Indira Gandhi be toppled from power again soon, it may well enable the CIA to put the original takeover plans back on track. And that would probably restore the original plan for war on the United States by way of an attack on the Panama Canal by atomic missiles fired from Guyana. The Helsinki Summit Conference now freed Soviet Russia to turn her attention to the east, that is, to China, and try to encircle China. Let's all pray that the ugly plans for conquest by the Rockefeller brothers will yet be stopped. And let's all do our part as citizens to cause these plans to be stopped. Let's bring them to justice for stealing our gold. And from there, let's start restoring sanity, integrity, and true representation in our government. The Constitution, my friends, protects all of us. And we should vote out all those people who are now in the control of the Rockefellers. We should break up their large socialist corporations and reestablish free enterprise. We should eliminate the large corporate and subsidized farms and return the land they own to individuals for small farms. And we should eliminate the personal income tax with its resultant enslavement of the middle class and the poor, while the Rockefellers go relatively free of tax by their use of tax-free foundations and devices. Thank you. Until next month, this is Dr. Beter. God bless each and every one of you.